We're in a series that you'll note in the front of the bulletin called The Pentateuch, A People for God's Purposes. The Pentateuch. And the Pentateuch just describes the first five books of the Bible written by Moses: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And we saw last week the promise given to Abraham. And even though this is a little bit simple and schematic, what we see is that the blueprint for God's redemptive plan is that he chose Abraham and he promised Abraham, I'm going to make you a great people. Second, I'm going to give you the land. And I am going to bless you, restore to you all that you lost, all that human beings lost as a result of sin and the curse, I'm going to restore to you in blessing. And the first stage, building a people, the second stage, a land, and having them as a blessed people, was to the end, God said, the goal and purpose of it all was to bless all the nations on the earth, to incorporate all the nations into this covenant that they too might experience that blessing. That's the end God has in view. And so we saw the beginnings in the book of Genesis of the way God continues to remove barriers to begin to build this people. And we see through the Pentateuch, all that's taking place is to build a people for his purposes. And then in Joshua, they're going to be put on the land, and well, that's another story. But we are looking at the building of this people for the purposes of God. Now I want you to, in your imagination, come along with me for a moment. Imagine I owe Harry Kirschbergen $1 million. You sat where Lynn did last week. That's why you're being you. Let's suppose I owe Harry and Evelyn, of course, $1 million. And I simply cannot pay that money. And let's suppose the law of the land, and this has been true of many ancient civilizations, it was true in Israel, and it was true in Egypt. Let's suppose that in order to pay my debt, I take my son, David, and I give him and his whole family, Dave, Brittany, and their kids, over to Harry and to Evelyn, and they are bound in slavery to the Kirschbergens to pay off my debt. And so they work a full lifetime. They work hard. You know how hard Dave works. And he's working hard for the Kirschbergens to pay. But you know, at the end of his life, $1 million is a lot of money. He still can't pay it off because the interest is growing. And so Levi, and maybe other sons that will come later, they and their wives now go into slavery. And they remain in slavery now to the Kirschbergens' sons and daughters. And it's a perpetual kind of thing. But let's suppose that to save my own skin and Dave's skin, somebody comes along. And they might pay the debt, or they might go back and show something in the law. But they do something that liberates Dave and Brittany and kids from the Kirschbergens' clutches and takes them out of that bondage and restores them to the home where they rightfully should live, the groom, the Goheen home. If somebody did that, they would be called a redeemer. They would be somebody who is acting redemptively to take somebody out of bondage and restore them to their rightful home. Now in Exodus 6:6 and Exodus 15:13, we are told that God redeemed Israel from Egypt. And he calls Israel his firstborn son. And the imagery that that is meant to conjure up in our minds is that Israel has come under bondage to the wrong people, people that are not their family. And they are being oppressed in slavery and in bondage. But God himself is seen as a redeemer. And as a redeemer, he comes and he doesn't pay any kind of debt. He acts with a mighty hand, and the word mighty hand and arm is used throughout these 15 chapters. He acts with a mighty arm and a mighty hand, and he takes his firstborn son, and he removes them from the clutches of Egypt, and he restores them to himself, to the home where they belong, as sons and daughters of the living God. That's what the story that we're now going to tell in the first 18 chapters of Exodus is all about. Now, there's one more thing before we unfold this story that you need to understand that is very hard for Western Christians to get their mind around, or Western people in general. Because our cultures work very differently than pagan Egyptian cultures, or for that matter, any ancient Near Eastern culture. Well, even in some cultures today. But here is what we must understand, that in Egypt, politics and religion were one and the same thing. In other words, for Egypt, the Pharaoh was the firstborn, literally speaking, in terms of their religion. He was the firstborn son, the image of God, the image of especially the sun god Re, the image of the Egyptian gods. And he ruled on earth on behalf of the Egyptian gods. And so when he spread his power throughout the earth, it was the Egyptian gods that were ruling over the earth. And so he was seen as the image of God ruling on behalf of the Egyptian gods. And so what is happening here, and this is what we've got to have deeply in our minds, is God chooses his man, as we're going to see in a moment, Moses. And he sends them to Egypt, and the two face off. I see in chapter 5, Moses and Pharaoh coming face to face like two boxers in a ring. Have you seen that? And they come nose to nose. And Moses, who is now representing Yahweh, the living God, says, Yahweh says, let my people go. And Pharaoh, who says, a little slave people, who is your God? I serve the greatest God in the entire gods of the entire world. And he says, I don't know who Yahweh is, and I will not let your people go. And what ensues is a battle. A battle that seems to be, on the outward surface, a battle between Moses and Pharaoh. But if we have clearly in our heads this ancient Near Eastern notion, the battle that is taking place is not a battle between Moses and Pharaoh at all. It's a battle between the living God, Yahweh, and all the gods of Egypt. And the whole purpose is not only that Israel will be redeemed, but the name of God will be magnified and glorified, and as we'll see in a moment, people will say that he is the only God. So keep in mind here that this battle that is taking place is a battle between the living God and the gods of Egypt. And the purpose is, as I said, as we see in Exodus 6:6 and 15:13, is that Israel will be liberated from the clutches of not only the Pharaoh and Egypt's bondage to slavery, but from the idolatry that was imposed on them by living under the Pharaoh. And that they will be liberated from that idolatry to serve fully and completely the living God. Now, I'm going to make three points that I think are clearly made in this text about redemption. And the first is that Israel is redeemed by a mediator. He's redeemed by a mediator. There is a little text which is appropriate for this morning in 1 Corinthians 10 that is actually remarkable. The phrase found in 1 Corinthians 10, I remember hearing a lecture on this and that person saying, this is a remarkable, remarkable little phrase. Here's what it says, that Israel was baptized into Moses. Isn't that remarkable? Israel was baptized into Moses. Clearly, what Paul is doing is making a connection between the fact that the church in Corinth knows that they have been baptized into Jesus Christ. And what does that mean? That means they have been aligned. They start with the Corinthian church. We have been aligned with the living God by attaching ourselves and being united to Jesus Christ. And we will know and experience and are all that Christ has known and experienced because he has taken our sin and giving us new life. In other words, our futures are tied to being united to Christ. We die with him, we rise with him, and we will be finally one day resurrected fully with him on the new earth. We are baptized into Christ, united to him and aligned with God. And here is the remarkable statement from 1 Corinthians 10. Israel is aligned with God by being united to Moses. And what God is going to do through Moses, Israel is going to benefit and participate from God's work through Moses, the mediator. Now, let me read beginning at verse 23 of chapter 2. And what we see is this, here is this. During the long period, what has happened, I should say, is that there have been 400 years since the end of Genesis. And when Israel went down into the land, they were about 70 to 100 people. And now 400 years later, they number in the millions. They have grown incredibly in their time in Egypt. And now what has happened is a Pharaoh has come up that didn't know Joseph, wasn't taking care of Israel, and has enslaved them. And verse 23, during that long period, the king of Egypt died, and the Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their help, cry for help, because of their slavery, went up to God. And God heard their groanings, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham. I'll make you a great people, and I'll bless you. With Isaac and Jacob. So God looked on Israelites, and he was concerned about them. But here's what the writer wants you to know if you've been reading from chapter 1. God has already begun to act. He's protected Moses in the reeds when all the little baby boys were going to be killed. He's protected him, and he's already begun to raise up his mediator to save them. And so he hears their cries, and he's already begun his work where he's going to redeem them from slavery. Now Moses has become a man. You know the story. He's run out into the wilderness because he had killed a couple men and they found out and Pharaoh wanted to kill him. And now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, now in the wilderness, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, which is Mount Sinai, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. And Moses saw that through that though that bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. And when the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. Do not come any closer. God said, take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And at this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. And the Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I've seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go. I'm sending you, and let me paraphrase here, to the most powerful person on the entire earth to bring my people upon whom their whole economy is built and bring them out of Egypt. Go to the most powerful person on the earth and say, release all of those upon whom your economy is built. No, Moses. Yeah, right. And God says, I'll be with you, and this will be a sign to you that I've sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you'll worship God in this mountain. Now, you can bet what's going to ensue in the next few chapters is Moses saying, I don't want to go. I don't want to die. I don't want to go to the most powerful man on the face of the earth. And God makes him go. We're not going to go through that whole story. If you can get a hold of Ken Miedema's telling of this story in song, you should. It's one of the funniest songs you'll ever hear. Anyway, I'll leave that there. And Moses doesn't want to go. And he says, suppose I go and say, the God of Israel's fathers has sent me to you, and they ask, what is his name? What do I tell them? In other words, who are you, God? And what are you going to do for us and them? And God says to Moses, I am who I am. And most scholars would say that that's better translated, I will be who I will be. It could be either. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. And God said to Moses, say to the Israelites, Yahweh, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has sent, but this will be my name forever. That is Yahweh. I will be who I will be. The name you call me from generation to generation. Moses is protected. He's called. God overcomes his hesitancy, and you would be too. But then he says, Yahweh has sent you. I suspect that trying to understand this name Yahweh occupies Old Testament scholars almost as much as anything else in the entire Old Testament. Because this is going to be the name that's used thousands of times from now on. And remember what I said last week. A name is not just a mere vocable, Mike. It's what does that name mean? And the name clearly is working with the verb to be. Either I am who I am, or I will be who I will be, or I am who I will be, or I will be who I am, or any one of those combinations. I suspect it's I will be who I will be. And I can't go into the details, but I'm going to suggest to you what is now not a consensus, but a broad understanding of most scholars of what this name means. It's this. I will be who I will be. You want to know who I am? There is no name that captures all of my glory. If you want to know who I am, watch me. And I will be who I will be. You watch me. When I bring my power down in the Egyptians, you'll see me as a God of power. When I'm faithful to my covenant, you'll see me as a God of faithfulness. When I'm compassionate to an erring people, you'll see me as a God of grace and love. In other words, I will be who I will be. Watch me. Watch what I do. See my mighty acts, and you will know who I am. Now, this isn't very comforting to Moses. You will be who you'll be. Yeah, but what do I tell him now? They need to see who you are. But Moses is overcome, and he goes back. So we see that, first of all, that Israel is going to be redeemed by a mediator. But the second thing is, they're going to be redeemed by mighty acts of judgment. Turn over to chapter 5, and I'm going to read a few verses beginning at verse 22. Listen for that phrase, mighty acts of judgment. What's happened here is Moses has gone back. He said, Yahweh's going to let you go. He's going to take you out. And they said, oh, great. But then they are inflicted with more work. They get angry at Moses. They try to send him away. And Moses is sitting there, what did you do this to me, God? And he begins at verse 22, and he returns to the Lord, chapter 5, and said, why, Lord, have you brought this trouble on this people? The Egyptians are mad now. Is this the way you sent me? Ever since I went to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he's brought trouble on this people, and you have not rescued your people at all. You've done nothing. Then the Lord said to Moses, now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. Because of my mighty hand, he will let them go. Because of my mighty hand, he will drive them out of the country. God also said to Moses, I am Yahweh. I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as El Shaddai, but by my name, Yahweh, I did not make myself known to them. I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, where they resided as foreigners. Moreover, I have heard the groaning of the Israelites, whom Israel, the Egyptians, are enslaving, and I have remembered my covenant. Therefore, say to the Israelites, I am Yahweh. And I will bring you from under the yoke of the Egyptians, and I will free you from being slaves to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God. Then you will know that I am Yahweh your God, who brought you out from underneath the yoke of the Egyptians, and I will bring you to the land I swore with an uplifted hand to give Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. A mighty act of judgment. On who? On who is God going to unleash his mighty act of judgment? We're talking here about the plagues. I don't think I could list them for you, so I'm not going to try. Blood, turning the Nile into blood. Frogs, have a whole bunch if you want. Gnats, covered in gnats. Flies. Plague on the livestock, boils, hail, locusts destroying their crops, darkness, and the killing of the firstborn. Those are the 10 plagues, the 10 mighty acts of judgment. It's one of the most dramatic, I think, pieces in the entire Bible, this coming and this fighting between Moses and Pharaoh and God's mighty acts of judgment. Who are these mighty acts of judgment on? Chapter 12, verse 12, tells us clearly, I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. Remember, this is a battle between God and the gods. What is taking place here? Well, there is a Nile god. And that Nile god protects the Nile because that's the source of their water. Actually, there's three Nile gods that protect the water. And in fact, many scholars think that when Pharaoh is going down in the morning to the Nile, he's not going down to bathe, but going down for his daily devotions. He's going down to worship this god. And so God says, you think those are gods? Watch what I do. And he turns the water into blood. One of the major gods of Egypt was a frog god named Hekt, H-E-Q-T. And we have pictures of them from ancient Egypt, the frog god Hekt. So God says, you think the frog is a god? Okay, have some more. And he gives them all kinds, and they're covered with frogs. The livestock. One of the major gods of Egypt was the cow gods and the bull gods. As a matter of fact, there is a relief of the pharaoh, likely, at least if you're a conservative reading of Egypt, of Exodus, likely the pharaoh who did not let Israel go and is drowned in the sea, there's a picture of that pharaoh drinking milk from the udders of one of the cow gods, as if he's receiving life from this cow god. And God says, you think that's a god? And he covers them in plagues. There is a god of medicine who is to protect them, especially from things like boils that came in that kind of climate. He says, you think that god can protect you? And he covers them in boils. Well, we could continue on and take each one. There's a god who's to protect the crops. He says, you think that god, Seth, can protect the crops? Watch when I bring locusts. What he is doing is he is bringing mighty judgment on the gods. And when he gets to the ninth plague, the primary god of Egypt was the sun god Re. And so what he says is, you think that's a god? I created that to rule the day. Darkness. That's no god. That's my creature. And he wipes the sun, and it becomes dark. And then the final act would have been a blow to the relationship between the gods and Egypt. You think that Pharaoh is the firstborn son who now brings that kind of religion into Egypt and that order into Egypt? You think that? I'm going to show you that I can kill your firstborn son. And I'm going to show you that I want my firstborn son, because I am the living God. I'm going to redeem him, them, out of Egypt. And so the final plague is that final act on the Egyptian gods. Now, if you turn to 9, 13 to 16, you'll see what God is up to. And this is one of a few places where he tells us why he did the plagues. He says this, chapter 9, verse 13, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Get up early in the morning and confront Pharaoh.'" He's been doing this quite a bit. Maybe he's going down to worship the Nile god, but stinks down there now. But anyway, "he confront Pharaoh and say to him, 'This is what Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, says. Let my people go so that they may worship me. Liberate them from the bondage to Egyptian idolatry so they may give their lives fully to me, serve me, worship me, love me. Or this time I will send the full force of my plagues against you and against your officials and your people so that you may know that there is no one like me in all the earth.'" So that you may know there is no one like me in all the earth. I want you to see. I want all of Egypt. I want all of Israel to see who the true and the living God is. For by now I could have stretched out my hand and struck you and your people with a plague that would have wiped you off the earth, but I've raised you up for this very purpose, that I might show you my power and that my name might be proclaimed throughout the whole earth." This is what God is doing. This is not a mean God who's bringing bad things on the Egyptians. This is a God that says, "You're worshiping the wrong gods, and I'm going to show you the true and the living God." And I believe, we can't prove this, I believe there were many Egyptians who became believers during this time. Because we're told that Egyptians start saying, "Pharaoh, let them go." And we see that when there's about a hail about to come, these Egyptians say, "We know it's coming," and they pull their flocks back. In other words, they're believing now the word of Moses. The point is, you're serving the wrong gods, and you've got my firstborn son under your authority. You are to let them go, and I'm going to show you who the living God is. This is about showing God's name and power and demonstrating his majesty throughout the earth. Well, it comes to a climactic moment when the firstborn is killed, and we see the third thing, that Israel will be redeemed by the blood of the Lamb. Redeemed by a mediator, redeemed by mighty acts of judgment, and redeemed by the blood of the Lamb. The last one has to do with a lamb and has to do with the Passover. And God says, "I'm going to send finally my angel, destroying angel." And when he does that, he says, anybody who wants to be saved, Israel or Egypt, should take a lamb, take its blood, put it on the lintels of their door, and the destroying angel will pass by, and they will not experience God's judgment. But those who don't will experience God's judgment. And that's what happens. And then they are told, from now on, you're to have a meal called the Passover, which you're to be reminded of that central event where I brought you out by the blood of the Lamb. Well, we won't say much more of the story, but they come out, They go through the Red Sea. I can just picture them. Many of them, have Egyptian names with the names of their gods, and they're coming through and they're saying, who is this God that can not only do that to the Egyptian gods, but bring the waters back? Who is this God? And they get out into the wilderness, and he provides them with water, and he provides them with food, and provides them with everything they need, even though they complain. Well, we'll pick up the story from there next week. But here is what we need to hear. We need to hear about a mightier act. There was a Jewish rabbi that became a good friend of mine when I was in Florida. And he said, I learned a lot about the Jewish faith, but I learned even more later about my own Christian faith. I think he understood the Christian faith better than a lot of Christians. I did a number of studies with him, and I remember him saying to me this. It's a lot more to this that I can't tell you the conversation, but it says something like this. He says, you Christians think that what defines you is your theology. He says, but we Jews know that what defines us is a mighty act of God. What he did in Egypt and how he covenanted with us at Sinai, that's what formed us into a people and gave us our identity. You think, he said, you Christians think that you have your theology. I was a brand new Christian, didn't know quite what to say. I said, oh, but now I know what he was thinking because I continued my studies with him. I know what he was thinking. He was thinking, you Christians got it wrong. If you really understood your own faith, he said, you would know what you believe. I don't believe it. I don't believe it, but what you'd believe is that there has been a mightier act of redemption. That this act of redemption in Egypt was only a shadow. Only a shadow of that mighty act of redemption that was coming in Jesus Christ. In fact, Israel was redeemed. But what do they do as soon as they get out in the wilderness? They turn back to the Egyptian cow god and worship the golden calf. They could be redeemed out of Egypt, but the idolatry was still in their hearts. And so what was needed was a far more powerful act. And the New Testament is not shy about taking all this imagery from Exodus and heaping it on Jesus Christ and showing that it's not flesh and blood that we battle with. It's not the Pharaoh. It's what lies behind the Pharaoh. It's not the gods they have made up. It's the powers of darkness that lie behind. That's where our real battle is. That's what's gripping our hearts in idolatry. And so a mighty act of redemption has to be more than taking us out of Egypt or out of Canada or out of anywhere. It has to be something that confronts and defeats what really lies behind Egyptian idolatry, Babylonian idolatry, and Canadian idolatry. What we need to know is that we have been formed also by a mighty act of judgment. Jesus, the Passover Lamb, has taken the sin of the world upon himself. In that act, he has enacted, we're told in Colossians 2:15, a mighty act of judgment on the powers of evil that lie behind the evil in this world. And we realize that as we are attached to that mediator, baptized and hold in faith to that mediator, it's that event which now defines the people of God. This vivid picture in the Exodus is merely a shadow of what was coming. And the book of Hebrews tells us that Moses is one of the most mightiest mediators of the Old Testament. Here's what we're told. He was only a son. He was only a servant in the house. Jesus is the son. That Jesus has come as the mediator to accomplish a full and free redemption. That is, a liberation from the clutches of sin and evil and idolatry, and a freedom and a liberation so that we might serve the living God with the fullness of our being. And we're going to see next week, when we see that God takes them and now covenants with this free people, that he's going to say to them, I'm now going to bless you so that the nations might be blessed. And so I end with this, that this event is not something that took place, well, it took place once for all, but not something that we appropriate once for all. It's something that we return to again and again. Our baptism reminds us, as 1 Corinthians 10 says, because you know what it goes on to say? Israel was baptized into Moses. They received spiritual drink and spiritual food. They seemed to have everything, yet God was not pleased with most of them because they set their heart in evil things. And so God destroyed them in the wilderness, and he'll judge us too. And so he invites us to return to Christ, to again receive his life. And I think that if we are to live out of this event, we've got to have that same sense of helplessness that Israel did as they stood in Egypt, a sense of being overcome by the power of Egyptian idolatry, and realize we are in such desperate need for a mediator who can liberate us. And apart from a powerful liberator who's liberated us from the cross and the resurrection, we will be encompassed by the idolatry of our culture. And so we are invited to take hold of that Christ again and again. And our baptism reminds us that we've been baptized into Christ. We can experience his death, which conquered sin, and his resurrection, which raised us to new life. The most powerful act of redemption ever. Not a shadow of anything, but the final act of redemption where God's people might be liberated for the sake of the world. Let's pray together. Lord, thank you for your mighty act of liberating your people from slavery. Lord, enable us to live in the freedom of obedience, the freedom of faith, the freedom of love. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.